Here it is, August 25th, 2004, and my name is Lee Hansen, and I'm doing an oral history for the Industrial Relations Institute for History that we're going to write upon its demise. I'm here in the office of Don Schwab, professor of management, who's been active in the IRRI program for a number of years, and I want to get his take on things. Don, can you tell me a bit about where you did your graduate work and when you came here and what you've been doing since you arrived?
Okay, I got my PhD from the University of Minnesota, and I majored there in industrial relations. So I was interested in Wisconsin both for the position in the business school and because we had an IR institute here. Mm-hmm. Came in the spring of 1967, just in time to get in on the Dow Chemical riots, where I was teaching a staffing class at the end of the Commerce Building when the riot broke out. That was my welcome to Wisconsin.
But you survived it.
Interestingly, I was in class and I heard this banging sound, and I went out of the classroom to see what was the banging. Well, the banging was when the police missed the students and protesters and their nightsticks hit the lockers. That was the banging. So I went back into class and I told the students that it would probably be in their interest to file out the back door. And as the students were filing out, I walked down towards the police with my arms raised, signaling peace. They didn't slow down. I decided it would be wise for me also to leave out the back door. Yeah. And we had a chancellor, the sociologist, you remember his?
Yeah, Bill Sewell.
Bill Sewell. I don't know if it was that day or one of the days following. He'd just been appointed chancellor, I think. And I was standing out in front of Granger, and Sewell was standing there wringing his hands as the police and the students were battling, and I thought, this guy isn't going to be chancellor very, very long, and I don't think he lasted very long.
No, 1 year, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And then Ed Young, who was more familiar with that kind of thing, took over the job.
So what have you been doing in the business school? What's your role here? I mean, what has it been over the years?
Okay, my teaching in the business school has been in the human resources area. Mm-hmm. So I had kind of from the beginning, when I came here, I started teaching the hello to human resources at the undergraduate level and the graduate level. So right away I got introduced to the industrial relations students. Mm-hmm. And I think Jerry Summers was the director at that time. And I don't know, I got on some kind of committee, so I started seeing the people in the institute. And I also, at the time, a lot of the master's students in the IR program were doing master's theses. Mm-hmm. And I started supervising those. I probably supervised a dozen master's theses in the first 6-7 years that I was here. And then also, Herb Heinemann III was a doctoral student in the IR program, and there really wasn't anybody kind of doing research in the HR area, so he very quickly became my student. So very early on I was sort of attached to the institute, at least in terms of involvement with students.
Yeah. Had you studied with his father, Herb's father, at Minnesota?
In a manner of speaking.
Yeah.
His father and I didn't get along.
Oh,
well,
I see.
But we had two Congress, he was my official chairman.
Right.
And over 2 years, we had two conversations. Once, when we were standing next to each other in the urinal, we said hello. And once I walked into his office and he looked over his half-rimmed glasses and said, "You dumb son of a bitch." I turned around and walked out. So we didn't get along real well.
So when did you then become involved in teaching IR courses?
I'm not sure.
Roughly.
Exactly. It was about 1970. Glenn Kane, I think, had been teaching the methods class and wanted to get out of it. And I very quickly got interested in kind of the process of doing research, the mechanics, the methods and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I offered to teach that class, and it was about 1970.
Mm-hmm. And
well, I was gone shortly after that. I took a year's leave at Kentucky, but I would say that after I started, there were probably at most 5 years when I didn't teach it.
Mm-hmm.
I taught it, I was gone for a semester at Minnesota, and I was gone for a semester at Purdue, and then I think there was a time or two when Randy Dunham taught it.
Yeah.
But for the most part, from whenever I started, roughly 1970, I taught it every year after that. And I'm not sure when we went from one class to two. It was sometime probably in the late 70s. So after that, most of the time I taught both sections of it.
And then you developed a book for the course, right?
That was, yes, but that was much
later.
Much later, It when we started out, you may recall that the proportion of doctoral students to master students was much greater then. So we had both doctoral students and master students in that methods class. And I don't know what Glenn tried to do, but I suspect he tried to do what I tried to do, is that is, somehow speak to both groups. Not very successfully. And so eventually, not too far into it, I proposed, look, let's make this essentially a master's level class. And it was also, there were two motivations for doing it. One, it wasn't working the way I was teaching it. And two, the proportion of doctoral students to master's students was getting smaller. There were, bigger chunks of master's students. Well, interestingly, what happened is when I made it a master's level course, it obviously became more valuable for the master's students, but I think it also became more valuable for the doctoral students, because there's such a tendency to assume doctoral students know more than they know. So it really, I think, became a successful course when I said, look, this is a hello to research methods rather than to try to be all things to all people.
So then, aside from your teaching, how were you involved in the administration or committee structure of the institute?
Well, I was always on committees.
Yeah.
I was on the selection committee for students. Most, and the executive committee. I was very heavily involved with the doctoral students as a doctoral advisor. I think I've had a total of, I've chaired 16 doctoral students. 15 of the 16 were IR students.
Really?
Only one was a business student.
Interesting.
So, that sort of mandates that you're going to be pretty actively involved in it. And when Jim Jones became director, which was sometime in the 70s.
Yeah, late 70s.
He made it a point to reach out to get participation on committees by, you know, less senior people. So, mm-hmm. you know, from his era on, I was always pretty heavily involved in committee assignments. I was never director,
mm-hmm.
but I was pretty involved on the committees.
Yeah. Now, what's the relationship between the Institute with its kind of human resource component? It used to be called personnel, I guess, mm-hmm. and manpower, and then the business school MA program, and maybe a PhD program in human resources.
Well, as you know, the Institute, it was a great strength of the Institute. It farmed out students to other programs, and it farmed out all of its HR courses were carried out by the business school. We have, in the business school, we have an undergraduate major in human resources. We never had a graduate major and a master's major in human resources. Mm-hmm. We have one now that the Institute is folded, but that's new, literally beginning this fall. We had business students getting Master of Science degrees, which were degrees that a student and an advisor could sit down and sort of, with very few constraints, put together any kind of program that we wanted to put together. And we did have some business students taking that program, but that looked very much like, because most of those were my students, and that looked very much like the IR program. Those students would take not only the business HR courses, but they'd wind up in the IR theory class, mm-hmm. the IR methods classes, and so forth. So we really relied very heavily on the Institute to kind of take care of the HR
mm-hmm.
side of the shop, and because the IR students were so good,
yeah.
particularly at the doctoral level, we sort of really didn't do much on the business school side.
Now, let's see, obviously the Institute is now closed. What do you think accounts for the demise of the Institute? You know, it was very strong in the 60s, 70s, early 70s, I mean, tremendous students, and was really strong until, what, mid-80s or so, and then seemingly went downhill. What's your sense of the chronology and the reason?
Well, I think there's some exogenous shocks. The decline of the labor movement in the private sector is the most significant at a kind of macro level. That resulted in fewer students being interested in going into the labor movement. It meant that government was less interested in funding research that was of interest to the labor movement. And the research that was funded, I mean, employment problems haven't gone away because the labor movement has effectively gone away, but that the pool of academics who were doing employment-related research was broader than industrial relations, and with the decline in industrial relations focusing on the union part, I think academics looked less to industrial relations as a sort of umbrella to hang their hat on. So we had a lot of people doing employment-related research at the University of Wisconsin who no longer had much enthusiasm for the Industrial Relations mm-hmm. Research Institute. So, you know, that and a kind of a broad framework, I think, sort of set the stage. And then the very institutional arrangement that was a strength in that it was truly an interdisciplinary program, so that people like myself, who came here employed by the business school, could get involved in the institute, and people in economics and sociology and psychology and law. There were no boundaries constraining participation, and the institute drew, in terms of the courses that it had, drew from all over the campus. That was a tremendous strength when there was a core of faculty interested in the institute. So we could literally compete with, what did we have, 4.5 FTEs or something like that. We could literally compete with Minnesota that had probably 25 FTEs, and Cornell that has a whole college. We had, in the HR side, we had far and away the best doctoral output in the country, with just this little small cadre of core faculty. But when time started to get tough, that great institutional arrangement that we had turned out to be a liability, because we didn't have sort of internal strength to protect ourselves against budget cuts and so forth. And then what had happened also happened nationally. I mean, as the union component went down, the human resource component went up. And our institutional arrangement worked to our disadvantage in that sense, because the institute was housed in the College of Letters and Science, funded by the College of Letters and Science, and the HR people who were contributing were all, of course, primarily housed in the business school. So I actually think that the college made a pretty rational choice. I mean, it's really sad to see a world-class organization get flushed, particularly when you look at all the other junk that the college supports. But looking at it from the college's point of view, there were not any significant core of letters and science faculty who were interested in maintaining the institute. And the institute was increasingly turning to business school, not only for faculty in classes, but also for administration. Craig Olson was the director for a number of years, and Dick Miller was a director for a number of years. So I think the college finally said, geez, why are we paying people over in the business school to run this, run and teach in this institute that we can't seem to get anybody from the College of Letters and Sciences to be interested in. So, Chuck Halaby took me out for lunch when he informed me of the college's decision, and I guess he thought my reaction was going to be more surprise or hostility or whatever than it was. It struck me as a rational mm-hmm. decision on the part of the college. They had to cut some some things.
Yeah.
And despite the glowing history of the Institute, looking forward, I don't think that they could see that there was going to be a lot there other than, for the foreseeable future, the HR part, and the HR part's in the school right. business.
And then, of course, Jerry Summers died in, what, 1977, and then Barbash retired, and Castle Ozanne.
Yourself, Glenn Kane.
Well, I was much later, 10 years yeah. later.
But, I mean, but it was, you know, sort of withering away.
Yeah.
I could remember
yeah.
saying probably at about the beginning of 1990, I said, you know, I'm looking at an awful lot of very familiar faces. Each year there's one less
right.
of us, unless we get some
mm-hmm.
something new going here.
Mm-hmm.
This place is going to go down the tubes.
Yeah. I thought things looked up a little bit when we recruited Craig, and then we got Streck, and then Zeitlin, and that history guy from, the guy from history.
Zondermann?
Zondermann, yeah, who didn't get tenure, but that... And then we had the guy from sociology who taught IR theory with Paula. But that ended up being just a kind of a blip on the screen.
Yeah, Zeitlin is the only one that,
yeah.
that was left from that
mm-hmm.
cohort.
Now, what about the, apparently there, Halby said there was some talk about trying to transfer, to have the business school take over the Institute or transfer it over here.
Mm-hmm.
What do you know about that?
Well, I was involved in putting together a proposal that would have brought the Institute into the, to the business school. We wanted money transferred from L&S
mm-hmm.
to the business school to cover the administrative
right.
part of it, and to cover some of the teaching. that at one point, Halaby and who was the dean?
Phil Sir.
Phil. Yeah. they started from the this point of view. What will you pay us for the brand name? And and we were talking about shifting money from L&S to the business school. So, you know, from the get-go, that didn't look like it was it was gonna going place. And we also, you know, we also had a new dean coming in at the time, and the dean, when he first came in, was well, he's very focused on the MBA program, and MBA programs recruit students with a lot of employment experience, not because it really cares about the employment experience, but it wants to bring in people who have high salaries so that when they go out they can have higher salaries. That makes the MBA program look good. Industrial relations students don't go out at high salaries. And so it wasn't, he was willing to sort of tolerate an effort to bring it in. We have a couple of other programs. We have an arts administration program,
mm-hmm.
for example.
Oh, yes.
You know, unattractive for the standard MBA things,
mm-hmm.
but it's kind of a nice niche
right.
program. And I think the dean was sort of willing to bring the Institute in on that kind of
mm-hmm.
basis. It's a good program. But he, you know, he clearly wasn't going to go to the
yeah.
mat to come up with any serious money on his own to
mm-hmm.
do that. So. We, you know, we sort of all went through some motions, but I don't think any of us ever thought that there was much chance that that it was going to be saved by coming to the business school.
Yeah. That proposal you mentioned, does Charlotte have a copy of that, I wonder?
I don't know if she does or not.
I wonder if sometime you could dig one out for me. It'd be useful to put in the archive.
Yeah.
Why don't I give you the sheet there? The Charlotte's archiving all the stuff, and actually Hallaby was very kind in giving her 3 months to kind of close things down. So she's been working in July, August, and through the end of September in trying to put things into shape. Meanwhile, she's looking, of course, for a job, which jobs aren't too plentiful now, and so she's quite apprehensive about that. But that would be nice if I could get that.
I probably have a copy.
Yeah.
Or Barry Gerhart was involved also. I'll check.
Okay.
If I don't have a copy, I'll check with him.
Good. So that didn't work. What about La Follette?
All I know about La Follette is what John Whitty told me or told us. We had meetings. And apparently there was a split in La Follette about bringing it in, and I don't recall what the split was. There were some people, I think the people who do HR, like what was the comparable worth guy's name?
Oh, Driesang?
Yeah, I think Driesang was interested in.
Yeah.
And but there were some people who weren't, and so that never went in place.
Actually, I'm going to talk to John next week and see what he has to say about it.
You know, also, just to kind of round out my perceptions of the decline and fall of the Institute, I think it was a leadership thing also, to some extent.
Okay. Leadership.
After Jerry Summers, I think everybody that was director, I know I'm stepping on toes since I know you were director, what, twice?
No, once.
Once. I think, you know, saw the job mostly as a kind of obligation to serve your duty for a couple of years, and there wasn't much in the way of institution building. And institution building in the case of the Institute, you know, we did have sort of several times when directors were interested in departmentalizing. But I think that institution building, given the institutional structure that we had, given the sort of interdisciplinary nature of the field and so forth, really would have been bringing in research funding. I think that's sort of how it got started to some extent. There was some research money around, and as an economist, you know, there's nothing that'll bring faculty around like the prospect of some dollars. And the directors didn't view their role in that way. And you know, without criticizing them particularly for that, I think if I would have been director at some point along the line, I would have viewed it pretty much like everybody else did. But I think that had a director taken a more entrepreneurial view about trying to develop research resources and so forth, that could have been something that would have potentially helped maintain the Institute over time.
Yeah, on that point, actually, the 1970s were the heyday for research money, and Jerry was very good at that. And then along came 1980, and all that employment money that Ray Marshall was, you know, helping to dole out for Carter as Secretary of Labor. All of that just dried up by
82. Yeah, that's, so, you know, that's so, part of the exogenous
yeah,
thing.
That's
that,
right. Yeah.
You know, it was decline of the labor movement. It was change of political parties and and so forth.
Okay, I'm going to stop now and then turn this tape over. Okay. It's really high-tech stuff. that made it hard, and then the foundations weren't giving money, et cetera. I don't mean to defend, but it was a lot tougher. I remember I had money in the late 70s and early 80s, and I was hiring 4, 5, 6 IR students a year. You know, they were, I had too many, really. I couldn't handle them all. But the money was so abundant, it was breathtaking. But then,
that really hurt hurt our ability to attract students when we, and it was also, it was, I have to take some responsibility for inadvertently hurting the Institute. We didn't have much of a doctoral program in the management department, in large part because we did business with, you know, those of us who were really involved with PhD students were doing our business over in the Institute. When I became chair of the department the first time was in 88 to 90, around that time period, I decided that I could contribute to the department by helping them get a more viable doctoral program. And one of the consequences of that is that we started bringing in better doctoral students into the management area, and we started diverting money that we used to spend on IR students on our own doctoral students. So, you know, that wound up hurting the Institute as well.
Do you think the world would have been different if the Institute had been given tenure granting authority, as it almost was in about 1977, when Dave Cronin was dean, and then again in 1984 that review committee recommended it, and we were almost very close. And again, I think there was an effort made in the early 90s to...
Mm-hmm. Which I don't think...
Got very far.
Got very far, Well, maybe. But I'm not sure that if that had happened, the Institute would have been worth saving. I mean, you can't have a world-class Institute with 4 or 5 faculty members.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were able to leverage, you know, so we could have our students taking econometrics from Art Goldberger. You know, we could leverage our little teaching component, faculty component, by being by utilizing all these other resources on the campus. And if we had 2 or 3 tenured faculty members, I suppose the Institute would be limping along. But I think, you know, I always opposed departmentalization. And I opposed it primarily because I just couldn't see us being able to have the fluidity across disciplines once we became departmentalized. And, you know, if that's correct, then, you know, if we'd somehow saved a department, you know, I'm not sure how good that department would be. You know, there's places like Michigan State has an industrial relations program. And they have sort of competing personnel programs with the business school. And the Michigan State program isn't any good. You know, there's, but anytime you have a department, you know, there's a tendency to, you know, well, we're going to do everything inside the department. And had it been possible to both departmentalize grant tenure and maintain the fluid relationships around the campus, then that could have been a good thing, and we might still have an institute.
It was interesting. I think Jim Stern, when he was director in our late, early 70s, I think he was the one that got some budget lines for IR. Before that, it had been run mostly out of econ, and you know, it was a part of the landscape. Barbash, Summers, all these guys were heavily involved in it. They were really the core of it at that time. And but then probably when you were coming along, Jim saw the need to get some lines, budget lines, so we could pay people outside the institute to do more teaching. Earlier, I don't think departments were very concerned about where people taught. You know, if you wanted to teach over there, go ahead and do it. But I think that began to tighten up, especially with the budget crunch in the early 1970s.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, you know, there's some sort of specific things that are certainly related to the budget crunch. But, you know, when the economics department decided that it was going to be pure and not applied, then suddenly guys like you were out of the mainstream, and IR and every other applied program started to have a stigma attached to it. And, you know, that had to hurt us down the road. Yeah, it's just, you know, there are a lot of external and internal things going on to take. The program was still good.
Yeah,
we were still placing students.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't get the best students as easily as we did in the past because we didn't have the financial resources. But if we'd had the resources to be able to fund the best students, I'm confident we could have continued to bring in top quality students. But the stars were aligned against us.
Yeah. Well, Don, this has been very helpful, very useful. Do you have anything more, other final thoughts that you want to voice?
Well, I wonder what the students who have degrees from the institute think. It's certainly not going to affect their employment in any way. I can't imagine, but both at the doctoral and the master's level, I would think some of those students have some pretty fond memories of the experience, and I would assume that they're kind of saddened by the fact that the institute's no longer in business.
Well, that's one reason why it seems to me important to do this history and then get it out to these people. It will sort of, you know, close the curtain on the whole thing, and they'll have their memories, but at least they'll have a coherent story about what happened and why the thing did come to an end. it would be interesting to get some testimonials to include in this history, although I'm not sure exactly how to do that. But you're right, those people coming through the program in the late 60s, throughout the 70s, into the early 80s, very, very good students. They've done very well for themselves.
Yeah, we've got a bunch of, a bunch of master's students that have done very well in business. I'm not as familiar with the students that went into the labor number that went into government very successfully. And, doctoral students have done, we've got doctoral students at major institutions mm-hmm. all over mm-hmm. The mm-hmm. world.
Yeah.
doing very well. It's in the HR side, which of course I know the best, but Cornell over the period of my most active involvement in doctoral work, Cornell turned out virtually nobody that was any kind of success in academia. Minnesota turned out some people, but I don't think Minnesota in its entirety turned out as many successful mm-hmm. people as I chaired alone.
Right.
It wasn't me that. It was, we got great students coming in. We had a great program here for the. Mm-hmm. We used to, our doctoral students in HR had to take classes, our staffing class, our compensation class, included advanced undergraduates as well as master's students as well as our doctoral students. So it wasn't like we were, having the core experience was, qualitatively different than anything else. But the program in its entirety, the quality of students that we had coming in, we just turned out a humongous number of people who went on to become very successful academics.
Yeah. Well, Don, let me thank you very much, and I'll be turning this tape over to Barry Tyker in the Oral History Project. They're housed out in Steenbach, and then I'll use them in writing this thing up, and then they'll be there for people who might be interested in learning more about the Institute. Somebody, I'm sure, will. So, thanks very much.
He said optimistically.